Good morning. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Every Monday, we talk politics, and boy, do we have a busy slate of topics to discuss this week. We begin with the California Democratic Party Convention held at San Francisco's Moscone Center Friday through yesterday, and it brought more than a dozen of the Democratic candidates for president, not the frontrunner Joe Biden, who's avoided these state conventions. He had another speaking engagement elsewhere, but there was a lot going on, including Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, who made a jab at Joe Biden in laying out her agenda.
Some say if we all just calm down, the Republicans will come to their senses. But our country is in a time of crisis. The time for small ideas is over. Big problems call for big solutions. If we're going to save our democracy, build an inclusive economy, clean up the corruption in Washington, we need big structural change. And yes, I have a plan for that.
Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts Senator, Democratic candidate for president, with us from Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, the bureau chief in our state capital, Ben Adler. Ben, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
Great to follow up Friday's statewide conversation with a recap of what happened. I've heard a lot of strong response to Senator Warren's address.
That's my perception, well, is that she, along with probably Pete Buttigieg and Cory Booker, had strong showings this weekend, maybe even stronger than expected. And Kamala Harris did not have the strongest showing in comparison, despite this being on her home turf. So, yes, I think Elizabeth Warren probably had a good weekend, and she was certainly testing out some arguments that we might hear her use in the debates later this month. It's in the eye of the beholder whether that cut you just heard was an implied criticism against Joe Biden or not. Yes. Well, and if you don't mind, I've got Cory Booker queued up, and he said something pretty interesting along the same lines. Let's listen.
I want to tell you what this election is really about. It is not about one guy in one office. It is about a referendum on who we are and who we must be to each other. Beating Donald Trump is a must. Beating Donald Trump is a must, but that is a floor, not a ceiling. We are bigger than that. We have greater ambitions than that.
And so there you have Cory Booker making the case as well.
Yeah, and the implication, I think, in what the senator there is saying is that beating Trump is not even the biggest challenge. There's a kind of assumption there that whomever the party nominates will beat the sitting president, and then it's a matter of who best can carry out the progressive vision where the Democratic Party is, in the eyes of the progressives, shifting. Did you get a sense, Ben, that that's kind of where people were at the convention, feeling as though beating Trump will not be that tough?
No. I don't necessarily think that's the case at all. I mean, maybe some people would think that. Some people might hope that. And sometimes a hope becomes a thought. But no, I think we sat down with four delegates, undecided delegates, and I don't mean delegates to the national convention. I mean California Democratic Party delegates. We just tried to find ones who have not yet decided how they're going to vote in the presidential race. And we sat down for a roundtable with them. And at least three of the four are really concerned about electability. Now, they have different conclusions about who would be the most electable. And in this crowd, which is more liberal than the voters in than Californians who vote Democratic, let alone the state of California as a whole, let alone the nation as a whole, you know, there wasn't necessarily a lot of support for Joe Biden in that group, although none of them said they would, you know, sit out the general if he won. But yeah, I mean, they're all a lot of Democrats really are looking for someone they think will be able to beat Trump. They don't necessarily think it's a sure thing. And it's, you know, every voter's trying to make their own decision about what electability is. And the candidates are trying to make the same cases, too. Bernie Sanders was trying to make the point that, you know, we don't beat Donald Trump by by doing the same thing. Pete Buttigieg said something similar. Status quo, not a recipe. You need to get, new voters energized in order to turn them out and win. So that is the debate going on in the Democratic Party.
We're talking with Ben Adler joining us from Capital Public Radio. He was at the Democratic State Convention, the Moscone Center in San Francisco over the past 3 days. Now, former Colorado governor and Democratic presidential hopeful John Hickenlooper got less than a warm reception when he made this comment.
If we want to beat Donald Trump and achieve big progressive goals, socialism is not the answer. I was reelected in a purple state in 2014, one of the worst years for Democrats in a quarter century. If we're not careful, we're going to end up helping to reelect the worst president in American history.
John Hickenlooper, the former governor of Colorado, were you in the room, Ben, when he was delivering that speech?
Yep. With a reaction like that, is it any wonder Joe Biden stayed away?
Wow. Which is interesting because just last week we were talking, we were doing a segment maybe week before last on could an atheist be nominated for president? And the Gallup poll showing atheism was such a negative. There was only one thing more negative for Americans in a candidate. The label of socialist was the most negative. So it's interesting. Hickenlooper sort of trying to tap into that and the delegates not having it.
And I think the booze might have been responding to because Bernie Sanders likes to say he's a democratic socialist. And I saw, some of his supporters make the argument that, the socialist thing is a straw man. If you want to say democratic socialist, OK. But, socialism is a buzzword and it can be used as a label, like any number of other labels in our political discourse. And Sanders folks, I think, were reacting because they felt that was an unfair argument, particularly for a Democratic candidate to launch. Hickenlooper also got booed, as did a lesser-known candidate, former Maryland Congressman John Delaney, when they both criticized Medicare for All, single-payer health care, and spoke of trying to reach universal health care within the existing system, although adding a public option to that. So there were boos for those candidates there.
We're talking with Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio. Now, while Senator Kamala Harris was answering a question about how she would address the gender wage gap, she was arrested by a man who came on stage, took her microphone from her, and wanted to make points about animal rights.
Thank you so much, sir, for your big idea. But we want to make sure that we are able to get through this. Okay, it's okay, folks. It's okay. People have their own big ideas. But we also want to make sure that we are being respectful to our folks that have come here to speak to us.
The moderator trying to get control there, and apparently there was lag time before the crasher on stage was escorted off. Were you there, Ben, to witness that?
So, Larry, that wasn't at the state party convention. That was at a completely different event on a different site in a different part of San Francisco hosted by MoveOn.org. So, no, I was not there. But many of the candidates who spoke at the convention also spoke at the Move On event. So I'm not really able to speak to that, but I've seen the video just like many folks have on Twitter so far. Her husband came up on stage and tried to help take the mic away from this person. I think you used the word arrested, and I don't think you meant arrested like, arrested by the police or that Harris was arrested and she wasn't. This person was arrested, but my understanding is just from reading other news reports is that he was not charged.
He was not charged, my understanding. And in fact, I got an email from his representative pitching for him to come on our program today. And I didn't think that was appropriate after he pulled a stunt like that. Highly disrespectful, not to mention dangerous. People could have been hurt by someone storming a stage, take a microphone like that. I assume, Ben, there's been universal condemnation of the man's actions.
It's not something I've looked around for, so I can't personally speak to that. It is certainly an assumption that could be made. It's also worth pointing out that there wasn't a heck of a lot of security that was visible, at least, around a lot of the candidates while they were speaking at the convention, nor were there metal detectors as we went into the convention hall.
Interesting. Wow.
So it's something to keep in mind.
Yeah, I that may change next time around. Thank you, Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio, with us. We'll continue with our political analysts in a couple minutes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking politics, and so pleased to have with us this week Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Also with us, Amanda Renteria, chair of Emerge America. It's a national organization training Democratic women to run for political office. She directed, was national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign, has been a staffer for noted U.S. Senators Dianne Feinstein and Debbie Stabenow as well. Amanda, let me start with you to ask you about what you think was most notable over these 3 days in San Francisco. Any needle moving, you think?
No, I think what you felt as you walked around the conference is you could just sense this energy, right? This is the first time that California is going to be part of that Super Tuesday crowd. And there's a certain sense of responsibility and energy around that. No doubt having 14 presidential candidates come in added to that and really did remind everybody of the important role that California plays. You know, not to mention the fact that people are testing out their different strategies and their different statements on the California delegate electorate. And so that part of it was also just a different sense at the California convention this time. And so it was pretty exciting to be there, pretty exciting to feel the energy. And there's no doubt that people were fired up to hear from the candidates themselves.
Is there any risk in the candidates playing for the crowd at a convention like this, which is different in a number of ways from the overall even Democratic electorate? They'd arguably those going to convention skew further to the left. So do candidates have to be careful about how they attempt to play to the live crowd?
To some degree, they do. You know, one of the things that a lot of folks had talked about, Governor Hickenlooper talking about socialism, and what I viewed in hearing through what happened in that conversation, it wasn't just that he was bringing it up, but the California way has always been very welcoming and open to new and innovative ideas, and so it was as much about him shooting down an idea as it is sort of being that welcoming conversation. It's always been true in California, not only in our innovative style of economics, but also within the political discourse of how we talk about new ideas and really welcome those new ideas. And so I viewed that as much more of a reaction of not understanding what our California politics look like.
Of course, for him, though, as a long shot candidate, he's trying to find what his avenue is. And so for him, if he's tacking you know, a little bit more to the right, then it would seem this would be a way to try and differentiate himself. Jack Pitney, your thoughts about what Hickenlooper tried to do?
It's a way of positioning himself for a general election. I'm not sure it's necessarily going to get a lot of traction within the Democratic Party. The conflict here is between playing to the base and aiming for the center. Hickenlooper obviously wants to go for the latter. The question is that the kind of approach that appeals to Democratic primary voters? It certainly didn't appeal to the people in San Francisco. And we just don't know if there is a large enough niche within the Democratic primary electorate for him to get some traction, because there are several other candidates who are also appealing to that niche.
Well, but certainly on the progressive side of it, Jack, there you've got so many candidates slicing and dicing that segment of the electorate. Does it open up a potential route for a more moderate candidate?
The fate of the more moderate candidates hinges on Joe Biden. If Biden stays strong, it's kind of hard to see how any of them will break out. But I think a lot of them are calculating that Biden has not always done well on the campaign trail in the past, and that if he should falter, there could be an opening for a more moderate candidate.
Like your former student out of Montana.
Yeah, Steve Bullock of Montana. That's an iffy proposition. We just don't know how that's going to play out.
So do you think Bullock and Hickenlooper and, you know, these folks are kind of – they're just waiting to see how Biden does. Essentially, they're the in-case-of-fire-break-glass candidates?
I think that's right. If Biden stays strong, the people who favor a more centrist or more practical approach to the Democratic nomination are going to gravitate to him. It'll be hard for the other candidates to get traction, but it's a long way until the primaries, and there are many opportunities for Biden to falter.
I wonder, Amanda, about Biden being absent. Do you think that made sense for him to avoid, or was it a mistake in your view for him not to show?
Well, I'm completely biased about the fact that everyone should come to California and visit all parts of California. But listen, I do think he should have made a stop here. I also recognize that relative to the other candidates, he's still pretty early in phasing in. How do you have a decision-making process for calendaring and scheduling? And I have to tell you, especially when you are in this particular phase of a campaign, that is the most difficult part, is figuring out where your candidate should be, particularly if you're a front runner, because there's a lot of expectations. And yet, on the other hand, you can actually go places and drive the media there and the news coverage there as well. And so it's this really careful balance. But in this case, since there were 14 of the candidates there, it probably made sense for him to come into town.
Amanda, your thoughts about what's going on with Kamala Harris, because it just seems like the attention she's able to garner is less than it was shortly after she declared. That in and of itself is not unusual, but it seems like it's hard for her to gain energy around her campaign, even here in California, where she's got the home field advantage. And I don't know how the stunt of the guy going on stage affects, you know, her one way or the other. Is certainly a disrespectful thing, in my opinion, to do, but and dangerous. But what do you think's going on with her candidacy?
So, you know, any sort of campaign goes through its roller coasters when you're in the spotlight and when you're just doing the hard work of call time and making sure to hit those numbers, because you know that headline is coming just around the corner. For Senator Harris, you know, she is both had high expectations for this convention, because she is a California senator, and on the other hand, people are looking for something new and different because they do know her a little bit. And so, you know, I look at this portion of the campaign for her that it is a time where the electorate's going to get to know the other candidates, and what is she doing behind the scenes to make sure that her policy is sound, to make sure that she's hitting her fundraising numbers, and it's something the campaign certainly is thinking through. What kind of events do they need to have going forward? And her role in the Senate will in and of itself give her those opportunities in committee to really showcase who she is as well. And so her story, I think, will continue to evolve over time, and her campaign will find those events. But right now, I can imagine that's exactly what they're doing to make sure that there are headlines again coming from the Senator Harris campaign.
Yeah, and it's sort of a long game that you're describing. I know South Carolina is also, you know, very key there, where they're counting on strong African-American support very early to raise the visibility. Jack, your thoughts about where the Harris campaign sits?
Yeah, there's been talk that she is in a bit of a slump. But again, it's June of an odd-numbered year. A lot can happen. There, in campaigns in the past, there are cases where people who eventually got the nomination had down periods. John Kerry was in that category. So it's way too early to say that she's down. That the one thing that we can say is that there's plenty of competition for the more progressive niche of the Democratic Party. She's going to have to work for it. Here in California, she can't automatically count on the support of California. It's a big state, and senators don't dominate the politics of a state the way governors can. So she's got a lot of work to do, but she's been around for quite a while, and she knows what to do.
Jack, you see any candidate helping or hurting him or herself coming out of this?
Again, the speculation is that she didn't help herself as much as some of the other candidates did. But again, this is for the activist core, isn't necessarily for the general electorate that isn't paying that much attention to the Democratic nomination contest yet.
All right. Amanda, if you did judge, you were there, you saw what the feeling in the room was as different people spoke. Who do you feel like really connected best with the audience?
I think Warren has continued to be able to really bridge the big ideas, policies, with really connecting with folks and really listening and understanding where they are. I think that was true again. I was at a forum about a month ago as well and saw the same thing occur. She really is honing her policy and connecting it to people's everyday lives. And that worked when I was in Houston, Texas. It worked in the room in California as well. And so I think her sentiment really hit it. And so did Cory Booker, actually. He got very fired up and took the crowd and took them, you know, with them on a journey of we can be bigger than this. I think the interesting piece about Booker is that part of his main point of his speech really was indirect, really was answering a question about Biden, right? All of a sudden, Biden gets in and Biden starts talking about Trump. And now every single candidate has to really think about that when they're on the stage. And I thought Senator Booker did a good job of really addressing that and bringing the audience to a new level of we can be bigger, we can be better.
Yeah, and as I've said many times, I'm just very impressed with how Elizabeth Warren just seems to be honing her speaking skills and connecting with an audience. It's been, since she was elected to the Senate, her sort of presentational makeover in how she connects with an audience is pretty impressive, the growth as a speaker that she's made. We'll continue our conversation with Amanda Renteria, chair of Emerge America, Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Much more politics to talk about as we continue right here on 89.3 KPCC. It's Monday, time for our politics roundup. That's what we're doing this hour of Air Talk. Coming up in our second hour, a brand new book which takes us back to 1981 Los Angeles, the arrival of Fernando Mania, and what that meant for the Dodgers and their fan base, in which Latino Angelenos dramatically increased support for the Dodgers, really adopting the team as Fernando Valenzuela arrived from Mexico. We'll talk about that later on, second hour of Air Talk. Right now, though, we're speaking with Amanda Renteria of Emerge America. She was the national political director for Hillary Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign. Jack Pitney, Claremont McKenna College professor of politics. Senator Ted Cruz, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez say they're teaming up on a bill that would ban lawmakers from lobbying. Jack Pitney, your thoughts on the potential for this?
It's a position that has a lot of support in both parties. Lobbyists are not held in high esteem pretty much anywhere outside the lobbying community. The trouble is the definition of lobbying. In recent years, a lot of lobbyists have so-called deregistered. That is, they're doing pretty much the same things they did before, but they don't undertake the specific tasks that require them to register as lobbyists. So if such a bill were to pass, that trend would probably increase. A lot of former members of Congress would go into the consulting business. They would do pretty much the same
lobbying
things.
Lobbying by another name.
Yeah. That's where the fine print would be very important. Is there going to be some language in the bill that would prevent that? I just don't know.
Yeah. And how would you write it in such a way? Because you wouldn't necessarily want to prevent former office holders from working in the private sector, but then when does it cross into de facto lobbying?
Yeah, right now the definition of lobbying involves such things as FaceTime with other members, things you can track. But when you get to the more consulting side of the business, that's much more difficult to regulate.
All right. Amanda Renteria, what do you think are the prospects for the bill?
I think whenever we have folks working across the aisle to try and really do anything together, we should be celebrating that right now. But I agree with Jack. The devil is in the details. I also think it really doesn't address some of the things that we're seeing right now out of the executive branch, where folks were lobbyists for a particular company or for a particular issue and then go in and employ those same kinds of ideas with the pen of the executive branch. And so I think there's more to be done, a lot more to look at here. hear certainly the details of it. But overall, we're having two very interesting people work together, and perhaps even some of the low-hanging fruit would be a good thing for our country to see right now.
Amanda, your thoughts about the president's visit to the UK today amidst the Brexit tensions, the announcement several days ago, Prime Minister Theresa May's resignation. Your thoughts on best possible outcome of the president's visit?
Well, it's a reminder of what President Trump has done, which means he undoes these norms around not only here domestically, these norms in politics, but even international norms, whether that's tweeting before he arrives, some negative comments to politicians there. It is, you know, you begin to realize how much that kind of activity really does change the dialogue. And so I am nervous about him out there, that a fight doesn't ensue, whether online or in the room, as he has tea time with the Queen. And I think it really is just, as I tangibly say that, it really is unfortunate that that is where our president is and the kinds of things that he is doing. You know, last time he was there, it was 250,000 people were protesting, and the baby Trump in a balloon came out. This isn't the kind of thing we want as America. So I'm actually quite nervous that he's out there right now.
Jack?
Well, as far as diplomacy goes, the Queen gave President Trump a gift, a rare book, and in a way that's a very smart way of preserving the book, since she'll be pretty sure that he'll never open it. I think Amanda's right. This is not diplomacy is not his strong suit. He'll do fine so long as he's just taking part in a ceremony. But when he starts commenting on internal politics, on Brexit, over the commenting on the leadership of the British Conservative Party.
Went after the mayor of London again.
Yes. And called him short, said he was a short version of Mayor de Blasio. And that doesn't really project a good image of the United States. And that's where he can get in trouble.
Jack, I also wanted to ask you about the presidential medal that's going to be given to supply-side economist Arthur Laffer, who was a favorite of President Reagan. Laffer, to sort of you can give the thumbnail of his view, is that as you cut tax rates, actual revenue coming into the government's increased because of the economic activity from that. Your thoughts about Laffer getting this honor?
I am not an economist, but I know quite a few economists, and I don't know any who have a very high opinion of him. There's a kernel of truth in that there is a certain point at which taxes yield diminishing marginal returns. But the kind of notions that he's peddled, that a tax cut would be self-financing, that's just hogwash. And the notion of giving a medal to this guy when there's so many really good economists out there is very disappointing.
What was your sense of how President Reagan, though, bought into the Laffer curve and his theory?
Well, Reagan very seldom went for the full Laffer. There are only a couple instances in which he hinted that the tax cuts might be self-financing, and it very early turned out that they weren't. And in 1982, Ronald Reagan did a mid-course correction and supported what was up till then the largest peacetime tax increase in American history, the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982. So although Laffer had some influence at the beginning, Reagan, under the influence of people like Bob Dole, very quickly changed course.
Amanda, I don't know if you have anything you want to say about Art Laffer. If not, your thoughts about this 5% tariff on Mexico that the president announced in a tweet last week.
Right. So I actually will comment a little bit on Laffer.
Sure.
My undergrad's actually in economics.
Oh, okay.
And when you look at the numbers going back, and I like to look at the numbers, when you look at the national debt during Reagan's administration, it did go from $997 billion to $2.85 trillion. We became the largest. We went from the largest international creditor to the largest international debtor nation during that period of time. So I think it's important to look at the influence that Laffer had at the beginning and the influence that Laffer had at the end and the full scope of what happened in the numbers. In terms of this, the 5% tariff that that Trump is out there. I think this is another indication of the way he runs foreign policy, the lack of careful deliberation, strategic thinking, even advising. His advisors didn't know what was happening. I mean, I know on Meet the Press, Mick Mulvaney goes on Meet the Press and talks about this impetus for it, this surge that happened, but actually got the location wrong. He said it was either Tijuana and El Paso, I don't know, one of those around there. So, I mean, it's just an indication of where we are right now and the way that this president is actually leading this country in economic deliberations. And there's no doubt that this will have an effect on our economy if it continues. I, having worked for the state of Michigan, one of the main partnerships that we have is on cars and auto parts. And the idea that the supplier market is going to be affected in the way that it would be with this kind of tariff is actually quite scary for what it means for certain parts of the states that I know Trump says he cares about. But this will have a damaging effect on that.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us this week. Amanda Renteria joining us, chair of Emerge America, which works to identify and train Democratic women for political office. She was Hillary Clinton's 2016 national political director and staffer for Senators Feinstein and Stabenow. Also, our thanks to Jack Pitney, professor of politics, Claremont McKenna College. Look forward to having them both with us shortly. You're listening to Where Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up in our next hour, we're going to talk about President Trump's visit to the UK and what sort of response he's getting there. We'll hear BBC coverage of that coming right up. Wonderful to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Many American presidents have visited the Queen of the UK, but just two, George W. Bush and Barack Obama, were honored with a state visit and its accompanying pomp and pageantry, including a horse-drawn carriage ride and royal banquet at Buckingham Palace. But we have President Trump arriving for a state dinner at Buckingham Palace tonight, meeting with Queen Elizabeth II, and with us to talk about the meetings of the UK political leadership and President Trump is Rich Preston, London-based senior broadcast journalist for the BBC World Service, who's outside Buckingham Palace. Rich, good to have you with us. Set the scene for us, please.
Well, good morning, Larry. Great to be on the program. I'm outside Buckingham Palace now, looking over the building that many of your listeners will be able to picture in their mind from those London postcards. It's 7:15 at night here, so it's kind of evening light, and there's hundreds of people on the streets outside. Now, as you mentioned, President Trump isn't the first to have a state visit to the United Kingdom. However, he is perhaps one of the most controversial. And so, as you can possibly hear in the background, there's a bit of noise, a bit of shouting from both groups that are protesting against President Trump's visit, but also groups that are supportive of President Trump and waving flags and banners in his favour. He landed here at around 9 o'clock this morning, local time, 1 a.m. your time, and arrived at Buckingham Palace, where he was greeted by Prince Charles and the Queen. He then inspected some of the regimental troops, the guys you'll be familiar with, and the red coats and the big bearskin hats. Then was shown some of the royal art collection, went on to lay a wreath at the tomb of the unknown soldier, and then he'll be arriving back here. We're expecting in about 20-25 minutes' time for that evening banquet, which will be speeches and a big posh formal dinner with various members of the royal family.
Will there be members of British Parliament who will be in attendance at this dinner tonight?
The dinner tonight is very much a royal affair. So a state visit is a visit that's hosted by the Queen. So President Trump visited last year. That was just a working visit. A state visit is a much more kind of, as you said in your introduction, much more about the pomp and the ceremony and the pageantry. The political stuff, Larry, that comes tomorrow. He's having a working meeting, a working breakfast meeting with Prime Minister Theresa May. They're going to be making a joint statement later on tomorrow. And he's got various other meetings that he's expecting to take part in as well. And later on in the week, we'll be joining other world leaders to take part in commemorations for the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings.
How does the opposition to President Trump, as well as you mentioned, there's some supporters there, how does that correspond to the domestic UK politics?
It's an interesting one, Larry, because normally a visitor on a state occasion like this wouldn't get involved in the domestic affairs of the country they're visiting. But as I'm sure you're aware, President Trump is very happy to voice his opinions. And in fact, before he even landed today, he was tweeting, criticising the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, calling him a loser. He was also commenting in newspaper interviews before he landed about who he thinks should replace Prime Minister Theresa May when she steps aside on Friday and how the UK should handle its Brexit negotiations. Now, politicians here have been very diplomatic. They haven't really commented much on that. But it's not really the norm for a president of the United States to get involved and wade in on political matters in the United Kingdom over here. And many people are saying it's not really his place to comment. He shouldn't be advocating for one future leader over another. He shouldn't really be telling us how to get involved in our Brexit debates with the European Union.
And I was wondering if those that are supporting the president, they're there, if they're generally pro-Brexit people, and those in opposition would generally be against Britain's exit from the European Union, or does it not necessarily line up that way?
No, that's definitely a fair comment, Larry. I mean, there will be some anomalies, but generally speaking, those who are supportive of President Trump are generally pro-Brexit as well, and those who are against President Trump are also against Brexit. And you find them citing similar kind of reasons for their opposition. So, for example, people who criticise President Trump, both regular people on the street but also politicians, talk about racist comments, misogynistic comments, being divisive, etc., etc. And they use similar arguments when they talk about the Brexit debate and the arguments that are given for Britain leaving the European Union being racist or against inclusivity. So there is a clear kind of similarity between the two conversations.
We're talking with the BBC World Service's Rich Preston, London-based senior broadcast journalist. He's there at Buckingham Palace, where, as he said, in less than half an hour, President Trump scheduled to arrive for a state dinner at the palace, as he's just saying, a very royal specific event. And then tomorrow he sits down doing more political business, Prime Minister Theresa May and others from the British Parliament. Rich, what is there pressure on the members of Parliament among their constituents to comment on the president, on the American president's arrival? Is that something that they're going to be expected to do?
I think people do expect their lawmakers to stand up for certain values. And several people have commented. They have taken a stance. So, for example, the main demonstrations we're expecting are going to be tomorrow. And the Labour leader, the opposition Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has already said he will make a statement at those events and that he will not be meeting President Trump. Emily Thornberry, who's the foreign affairs spokeswoman for the Labour Party, has described Mr. Trump as a president who's systematically assaulted all the shared values that unite our two countries. And she went as far as to say that unless Theresa May is finally going to stand up to him and object to that behaviour, she has no business wasting taxpayers' money on all the pomp, ceremony and policing costs that will come with this visit. And on that topic, Larry, $22 million to the British taxpayer. That's the expected policing cost of ensuring all the organisation and security is intact behind the president's visit. So there's definitely some strong opinion here. Lots of people to see the president arrive this morning, but it does come with that mixed bag of people being supportive of President Trump and people being very opposed to the kind of leadership position he takes on various matters.
Here in the United States, there are certain people who, you know, kind of benefit their stature and centrality when the president tweets against them. It ends up sort of, you know, benefiting their profile. Is that the sense of the London mayor? You were just mentioning Sadiq Khan and the ridicule that President Trump you put into his tweets before he landed this morning. Does that help Khan?
I think it does, actually. I think there's definitely some benefit. The mayor's office responded to those tweets, calling them childish and refuting what the president had said. But that obviously is taking a stance, and that puts the mayor, Sadiq Khan, into a certain position. It makes it look like he's taking the upper hand. So it definitely does benefit many politicians to be seen to be taking a kind of value stance against President Trump. But then there's also those who President Trump supports. So, for example, Nigel Farage, that's a name your listeners may be familiar with. He was a very ardent pro-Brexit supporter. He now leads the newly formed Brexit Party, which did very well in recent European elections. President Trump said in his newspaper interviews that he should play a stronger role in Brexit negotiations, and that he's a good guy, and that he should have the government's kind of full engagement and support. And whilst Mr. Farage hasn't kind of come back to publicly comment directly on that interview, he has said that President Trump's a good guy, he's a good friend, he's coming over here as a friend to Britain, and so it clearly benefits his position as well.
Rich Preston, BBC World Service senior broadcast journalist with us. He's outside Buckingham Palace, where in a few minutes President Trump's scheduled to arrive for a state dinner at the palace. Rich, as these conversations are held over the next couple of days, I think the president's visit, what goes through Wednesday, what is on the agenda for them to talk about?
Well, it's a tough one to say. There's a few things that we can be almost certain they're going to talk about. For example, our departure from the European Union, but nothing's officially been tabled. There's been no kind of, you know, we're going to address this trade point or that trade point. One thing that President Trump has said he wants to talk about is Huawei. He has mooted the idea that the United States will be less inclined to share intelligence with Britain if Britain continues to do deals and enters agreements with Huawei and gives Huawei access to our telecom system. And in reverse, various leaders here have said they want to talk to President Trump about climate change. Now, Prince Charles is a strong environmental advocate, so it's been hinted that he will bring up the topic of climate change with President Trump. And Theresa May as well has said that she will bring up the topic of climate change with President Trump. Of course, this all after the US withdrew from the Paris climate deal. So a couple of main things on the agenda, and the others, well, we'll just have to wait and see.
Rich, thank you so much. I know it's a very busy day for you, series of days. Thank you for taking the time to speak with our audience here in Southern California. We appreciate it very much.
Great to talk to you, Larry. Thank you.
Thank you. Rich Preston, BBC World Service senior broadcast journalist outside Buckingham Palace, where President Trump scheduled to arrive in the next 20 minutes or so for the state dinner. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Wonderful to have you with us. And you don't have to be a baseball fan to enjoy what we're going to talk about next. It's a truly dramatic, only in Hollywood kind of story, and it essentially did happen in Hollywood. The 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, a last hurrah for the historically long-lived infield of Garvey, Lopes, Russell, and Say, a last chance to try and get a championship out of that team. And the story of that Dodger year is told in Jason Turbo's brand-new book, They Bled Blue. Fernando Mania, strike season mayhem, and the weirdest championship baseball had ever seen, the 1981 L.A. Dodgers. But let's go back. Vin Scully calling Fernando Valenzuela at the plate in this magical 1981 season of Fernando Mania.
1-1 to Guerrero. Ratzer comes back to his hitter, and there's a drive into deep left field. That goes wide. It's gone, Fernando. It's gone. Tells it all. The Fernando Valenzuela magic is alive and well. Who's to say when it will end?
Wonderful, as always, to hear the great Vin Scully with that call. Jason Turbo with us to talk about a remarkable year. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me. And man, listening to Vin Scully order lunch would be a thing of beauty.
Isn't that great? Let alone something as dramatic as that home run. Set the stage for this season, because a lot was going on. We had a strike, which cut the season in two. I mentioned the aging infield. Lopes, the oldest, I think he was 36 at that point, but the others getting long in the tooth. This had a lot riding on it.
Correct. I mean, the infield had been together for going on 9 seasons, which, is, to put it in some context, is about twice as long as the next most durable infield in Major League history. These guys had been through 3 World Series together. They knew their time was short. The Dodgers farm system was loaded with talent. And to a man, they knew if they were going to win a championship, 1981 had to be the year because they weren't going to all be together in 1982. What they didn't count on was a kid coming from out of nowhere, setting the world aflame, as we just heard Vin Scully talk about. And Fernando Valenzuela really was the difference for the Dodgers between a lost season and a championship season that year.
This 20-year-old who comes essentially from nowhere speaks only Spanish. Now, the Dodgers had Latino fans. I was a kid going to Dodger Stadium. I saw a lot of Latinos at the stadium. But it hadn't really reached a critical mass. The Dodgers had long been trying to have that connection, even as fans listened to the broadcast from Jaime Harin on KWKW. They weren't getting the turnout that they ideally wanted.
That's right. And that's because of the Dodgers' kind of fraught history with Los Angeles before they arrived. I mean, once in Chavez Ravine was a thriving Mexican community, thousands strong in the early 1900s. That changed in about 1949 when the Los Angeles mayor decided that he wanted to build a housing project in Chavez Ravine. He displaced the community of Mexicans in order to secure this land. In 1953, I believe, he was ousted by a conservative Republican who branded subsidized housing as a socialist plot. You know, it was the height of the McCarthy era, and he scuttled the project entirely. Right? That left Los Angeles with a bunch of empty acreage and not much to do with it until Walter O'Malley decided he wanted to move his team out of Brooklyn. And it worked. I mean, the Dodgers, their last season in Brooklyn, sold about a million tickets. Their first season in Los Angeles, playing in the L.A. Coliseum, they about doubled that. For the next 4 years, they played in the Coliseum, while in Chavez Ravine, the mountains were leveled and valleys were graded, and Dodger Stadium was built. And once that ballpark opened, they set new attendance records almost every season.
Well, they arrived just at the time, too, as L.A.'s in the midst of a post-war expansion in population, so it's rising dramatically. And you have a lot of people who arrived from the East Coast who knew baseball, and all we had were two minor league teams here, the Hollywood Stars, the Los Angeles Angels, and the Dodgers were truly embraced. Let's talk a bit about how this team had really struggled in the 70s, despite all this talent. There was always the Cincinnati Reds in the Western Division that the Dodgers had to contend with. And the years they did get to the World Series, the New York Yankees were an obstacle.
That's right. They lost the World Series to the Oakland A's in 1974, made it back in 1977, got beat by the Yankees. Reggie Jackson hit a very famous three home runs in three swings. 1978, the Dodgers again played the Yankees, won the first two games, felt very much in control of their destiny, and then lost four straight. So they were delighted to get back to the World Series to have that chance. The Reds really stood in their way in a very, very major fashion. Even in 1981, the Dodgers, despite getting out to an incredibly hot start, were backsliding something mighty in late May and early June. They had a 6.5-game divisional lead over Cincinnati and were losing almost a game a day in ground. The Reds were catching up to them inexorably. The lead was down to a half a game, which is where the Dodgers got very lucky because at that very moment, the players' union decided to strike. And it's not fanciful to think that if the strike had occurred even one day later, the Dodgers might have lost that divisional lead. And that matters because baseball's reaction to the strike, which cost them 50 days of the season right in the middle, was to crown first-half champions and second-half champions. And that guaranteed the Dodgers a spot in the postseason. They held on by the skin of their teeth to that first-half championship. They did not win the second-half championship. Ron Say got injured. They struggled mightily in the last few weeks of the season. They didn't even finish with the best overall record in the National League West.
Wasn't Cincinnati the
Cincinnati did. Cincinnati record? Did. They didn't even make the playoffs, owing to the fact they won neither the first nor the second half championship. So the Reds were definitely the Dodgers' bugbear that year, but it didn't help them any. The Dodgers made the playoffs and the Reds didn't.
This quirk of the format. But the Dodgers still big underdogs going into the playoffs because they'd had such a weak second half.
That's right. They were dealing with injury. They were dealing with ineffectiveness. Fernando himself, after a world-beating start, literally just about the best start to a career in baseball history. His first eight starts of the season resulted in eight victories. He pitched nine innings in every single one of those games. He threw five shutouts. His ERA was 0.5, which, if you don't know, is really, really good. He had some rough starts in the middle of the season, but he came back strong, and he rounded into form just as the playoffs struck. To get back to one of your earlier questions, the Dodgers' inability to capture a Mexican fan base because of the displaced community in Chavez Ravine, Fernando Mania, which was in full bloom by the time he hit his fourth or fifth victory, turned that grandstand at Dodger Stadium into a giant mariachi party. Like, Al Campanis, the team's general manager, had long been saying that he wanted to find a Mexican Sandy Koufax, someone to activate Mexicans the way that Koufax had activated Jews. And he could not do it for 20 years leading up to 1981. Fernando gave him that guy, and almost overnight, that demographic, which was not insignificant, more Mexicans lived in L.A. County than anywhere in the world outside of Mexico City, that demographic was entirely activated.
Well, it's so ironic here, you know, with Mexico and Southern California next to each other, but Mexico did not produce large numbers of Major League Baseball players, unlike much smaller countries like the Dominican Republic, other Spanish-speaking countries where baseball, big part of the sports culture, produced a lot of players. Mexico didn't produce so many, and that made it very difficult for the Dodgers to find that gem.
That's right. I mean, unlike these other leagues in the Dominican and Venezuela, which compete during the winter and thus fold in major league players as part of an off-season training regimen, the Mexican League competes during the summer, didn't want to lose its star players to Major League Baseball, and thus tended to price them beyond the interest of big league teams. It wasn't that there was a lack of talent. Mexican League teams just didn't want to give up their players.
We're talking with Jason Turbo, author of They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. The 88 team, of course, gets so much attention because of Kirk Gibson's epic home run. They were underdogs there, too, against the Oakland A's. And that series took on a kind of mythical standing because of Gibson barely able to stand hitting that home run. But this 1981 team was absolutely key because of all the sorts of freakish things behind the scenes. And you also had this longest lasting intact infield with Garvey Lopes, Russell Say, which were barely on speaking terms with each other, but nonetheless had been very effective, a very, very potent infield. I'd like to hear from you if you're someone who fondly remembers that 1981 team and a particular memory of one of those players sticks in your mind. We're at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. It's a chance for you to share your memories of that 1981 Dodger team. I was one of those, you know, teenage kids who lived and died with every Dodger game through the 1970s with this infield. And also players, you know, like Reggie Smith, just a huge part, heart and soul of that team. Dusty Baker, of course, Rick Monday, Steve Yeager, the catcher, Don Sutton, the pitcher, others that were indelible parts of that, Andy Messersmith, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jason Turbo grew up a San Francisco Giants fan, but we'll excuse that because he's written a really terrific book on the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, the team that was his boyhood nemesis, now the source of a terrific book that he researched and wrote, titled They Bled Blue, Fernando Mania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, tells the story of the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers. Jason is going to be at Santa Monica's Diesel Bookstore tomorrow night at 6:30. And then he's going to be with sports writer Ron Rappaport talking about Fernando Mania Thursday night at the South Pasadena Library. That's a free event, starts at 7 o'clock. We have links with information on both the Diesel Books event tomorrow night and the South Pasadena Public Library event Thursday night on our Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Very pleased to have joining us, it's Rick Salinas of Silver Lake of Culture Clash. Am I correct?
Yes. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
I'm really good. I just want to quickly share that our most popular play that we've written, Chavez Ravine, which premiered at the Mark Taper Forum, we wrote the whole story of Chavez Ravine. The three of us, you know, Richard Montoya, Herbert Siwenza, you know, portrayed 55 characters and did the whole story of Chavez Ravine. But what we did, and I wanted to share with you, is that we used Fernando Valenzuela as our bookend. It opens up with him and then the spirits and the ghosts of some of the people that lived up there. They whisper in his ear and they tell him, come on, go do it, Fernando. And at the end, he strikes out the Houston Astros and he wins. And everyone would tell us, my home is right below home base. And there was a custom where they would bury the belly buttons when you were born and they would bury them under the house. So everybody would tell us, yeah, my belly button's under home base.
How funny.
So it was just a great opportunity to use Fernando. And everyone that we interviewed said the same thing. They said that they did not go back to the stadium until they learned about Fernando.
Hey, Rick, thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And it was a great production at the Taper, and appreciate you talking about the piece Chavez Ravine, Culture Clashes. Rick Salinas joining us on Air Talk. If you have a particular memory of that 1981 Fernando Mania, Los Angeles Dodgers strike interrupted championship season, 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. You can also comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Jason, let's talk a bit about the fraught relations between the Dodgers that have been together all these years, starting in the minor leagues. They arrive in Los Angeles. Very different personalities, the four men.
Absolutely. It's remarkable how well they played together on the field, considering I wouldn't call it antipathy off the field, but let's say they didn't hang out a lot together once they left the ballpark. I mean, Steve Garvey had this all-American image of you know, kissing all the babies and hugging all the nuns, and he didn't curse, and he was Captain America, and that image was genuine. Like, it wasn't a front for the public. He meant everything he said and everything he did. But he also tended to perhaps grandstand about it a little bit more than his teammates would care for, in the sense that, you know, he looked at someone who maybe didn't hang around and sign all the autographs with a little bit more disdain than they would have cared for. So there was some tension there. Garvey had, through no fault of his own, a pretty scattershot throwing arm. He was a great athlete. He played defensive back on the Michigan State football team. He got injured in college playing football, that ruined much of his accuracy.
I actually was at Dodger Stadium where I think it was his first game playing third base just after he was brought up. But he made an error, as he did many, and they gave up on him being a third baseman.
Correct. He led the league in errors in playing only 85 games as a third baseman. His arm was just not tenable at the major league level. He turned into a very, very good first baseman. His fielding was terrific. But when he had to complete double plays, again, his fellow infielders sometimes held that against him.
He was a very good defensive first baseman, though, I would argue.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's an argument. He won a gold glove. He was an excellent first baseman, except when it came time to throw across the diamond.
Exactly. And Davey Lopes, who had a little bit more of a, I don't know what you'd call it, not exuberant personality, a little more.
Davey Lopes was the most outspoken guy on the team, perhaps right alongside Reggie Smith. But Lopes had this amazing moment during the strike when, unbeknownst to him, they were very close to settling. The players' union and the owners were about to come to an understanding when Lopes gave an interview to a local newspaper here in Southern California, questioning everything, questioning the union's leadership, questioning their rationale for striking, not knowing why they weren't playing. And that was all ownership needed to see cracks in the veneer of what had appeared to be a very solidified union. And suddenly talks were set back several steps. It took some time for Lopes to understand this. But by the time he did, he came to the players' union meeting in Los Angeles. And as was his way, owned every mistake he had made. He apologized to the group. He talked to the press about how he had been wrong and how the union was right. which I think is a really admirable trait for somebody as off-the-cuff outspoken as Davey Lopes. And that's one thing his teammates very much respected, as angry as they had been at him beforehand. They all came to forgive him afterward.
My sense of Reggie Smith is that he spoke with a kind of gravitas that that maybe carried more weight with his teammates. But what in your conversations, what is your sense? My sense is that he was held in quite high regard.
He was. His teammates respected him to no end. 1981 was a very difficult year for him because he had injured his shoulder severely the previous year. He was unable to play the field entirely through the duration of 1981. He got in a couple innings at first base toward the end of the year, but almost every one of his appearances was as a pinch hitter. He couldn't play the field, and that wrecked him emotionally. He couldn't. It was hard for him to take not being able to play as well as he wanted to.
We're talking with Jason Turbo. His book, They Bled Blue, Fernandomania, Strike Season Mayhem, and the Weirdest Championship Baseball Had Ever Seen, the 1981 Los Angeles Dodgers, who in a strike-interrupted season by virtue of winning the first half of the season by a half game over the Reds, go into the playoffs, the league championship series, go to the World Series against the New York Yankees. They had two previous setbacks in the late 1970s against the Yankees. Did the players tell you that you interviewed there was any sense of dread about, you know, the third time, or did they feel like this was finally going to be their chance?
Very much the latter. I don't think anyone was afraid of the Yankees. One thing that going to three World Series prior to that point taught everybody was how to approach a postseason series in an effective manner. They knew that not only every game counted, and not only every inning counted, but every single pitch counted. And their focus was beyond reproach. And I don't think you could say the same thing for those Yankees teams. They made a lot of fundamental errors on which the Dodgers capitalized throughout that postseason, both from the manager and the players themselves. They saw this, these Dodgers, as redemption. I mean, they'd lost to the Yankees twice in a row in increasingly dispiriting fashion. Lasorda could not have been happier to get the Yankees as an opponent.
And it's quite remarkable that Lasorda was such a big personality and, you know, I'm sure his players at times rolling their eyes and, you know, looking at Tommy as almost a character, that he was able to lead them to not just this 81 World Series victory, but the one in 88, too.
Yeah, he was a larger-than-life personality from the time he was a minor league pitcher in the Dodger system. He spent 8 years managing in the minor leagues for the Dodgers.
And he was a national baseball celebrity as a minor league manager.
He was a cult, one-man cult of personality. The funny part is, naysayers said that it wouldn't work in the major leagues, but it did because his players who played for him in the big leagues also played for him in the minors. They knew what they were getting. He kept it right up, and they knew who he was.
And somehow, even with the motivational techniques he used, that they knew exactly what he was doing, it still worked.
Yeah. And that group of that infield that ended in 1981 all came up with Lasorda.
Jason, thanks so much. I appreciate it. His book, They Bled Blue, Jason Turbo, our guest.